You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, the effort to rebuild Iraq's power grid nearly 3 years after the statue of Saddam Hussein fell and billions of dollars in reconstruction money later, Baghdad is only running on about 6 hours of electricity a day. This week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee heard testimony about the reconstruction effort. According to the New York Times, of seven measures of public services performance things like sewage service, drinkable water, hours of electricity. Of those seven measured, only one was above pre-invasion values. And that's only the hours of electricity outside of Baghdad is better now than it was before the invasion. But that's also misleading because, according to my next guest, the hours of electricity outside of Baghdad have increased at Baghdad's expense. So it's how you look at it. Glenn Zorpet spent 10 days embedded, as they say, with engineers in Iraq and saw firsthand the obstacles to reconstruction they face. And here are some of them. And you have an insurgency bent on knocking down everything contractors put up, power plants that are idle because they can't get the fuel they need. You have an abundance of natural gas that is going to waste, literally just being burnt off because power plants are equipped with oil power generators. And he says a fragile new government that doesn't have the will to price electricity profitably. And that means there's no incentive for private investors to build power plants in Iraq. So Iraq seems stuck in a catch-22. Without electricity, there's no stability. Without stability, there's no electricity. And here to talk about that is Glenn Zorpet. He's executive editor of the IEEE Spectrum magazine. And his story about rebuilding Iraq's power grid is in the magazine's February issue. Welcome back to Science Friday, Glenn.
Great to be here, Ira.
Tell us about your trip, what you expected to see and what you saw when you got there.
Yeah, I guess like a lot of people, I was expecting some sort of terrified, scared engineers huddling in tents somewhere in the desert. But it was actually quite a different thing. First of all, the sheer numbers and volume. There are thousands of engineers over there. I was also surprised to find that there are engineers from every nationality, although much of the work is being directed by U.S. agencies and U.S. contracting companies. It really is an international crowd. I ran into engineers from the Philippines, Scotland, Canada, England, Uruguay, and so on. And many of them, the ones I was working with anyway, are based in the green zone, which I found to be surprisingly comfortable and safe. Others are at secured locations all over Iraq. But it's an absolutely enormous effort, as you can imagine from the dollar figures involved. They have some very good engineers over there. Mm-hmm. These aren't people who couldn't find jobs here, and this was their only option. These are people who had lots of options, really quality people.
So they're smart, they're trained,
exactly.
They're qualified.
Well paid. You forgot well paid.
So
very
well paid. So why are we not making what appears to be very much progress?
There were some very bad decisions made very early on. Perhaps the most catastrophic of these early decisions was to focus exclusively on a kind of generating plant called a combustion turbine. There are, I don't want to get into a college lecture, but there are, for the purposes of this talk, there are two key kinds of fossil fuel generating plants. One is called a steam thermal plant, and the other is a combustion turbine. And this decision was made back, as near as I can tell, in late 2003 or so, maybe early 2004, that they were only going to put combustion turbines in Iraq. The decision, and I spent a lot of time when I was over there trying to nail this down. Who made that decision? What do I mean by they when I say they made that decision? And I had a lot of people with different recollections, people who were there. I had one person who was there tell me that this was something that the coalition kind of shoved down the Iraqis' throats, basically. But I had other people who were also there at the same time, at the same meetings, who basically told me, oh, no, the Iraqis were on board with this, and we all decided that this is what we were going to do. I suspect that in reality you had factions of people. You had factions of the coalition people who were favoring combustion turbines, and you had factions that were arguing for the steam thermal plants.
Now, and you say that was the wrong decision to
it
go
was.
With the combustion turbine.
I think at this point no one would argue.
Why was that?
Good question. Okay, a steam thermal plant is what a lot of people think of as a big old dirty plant. It's you basically burn something, and that thing you're burning makes steam, and that steam runs a turbine. The beauty of this approach is it doesn't matter what you burn. I mean, you can burn oil, you can burn coal, you can burn whatever. A combustion turbine is a very different animal. In a combustion turbine, you burn a fuel, usually gas, and as that gas burns, it expands. And that expansion you direct through a turbine and you spin the turbine that way. So notice that what you're spinning the turbine with is the actual exhaust of your burning fuel. So now your burning fuel is much more important. And in fact, these combustion turbines, even if you're running them on natural gas, are a little bit more finicky and a little harder to keep going than a steam plant. A steam plant is easy to run.
Right.
A combustion turbine, if you're running it on gas, it's not so hard to run, but it's still different from a steam plant. But if you're running it, trying to run it on something other than gas, which not many people try to do, you've got big problems.
And so there are a lot of these combustion turbines around.
Right. The figures I got were they either fixed or installed 57 generating units so far under reconstruction. 40 of these were combustion turbines, and 30 were brand new installations. And that's it. They installed no new steam turbines. They installed 30 new combustion turbines.
So are we saying the combustion turbines either sit idle because there's no fuel for them, or they break down, or they're just sitting there?
A lot of them are just sitting there.
Right.
An unbelievable number of those 30. I don't have the exact number, but a very large number of those 30 are just sitting there. Iraq has a lot of natural gas. Very little of it is being captured, pressurized, distributed.
You said you saw how many flames there were
absolutely.
In the skies, like we see them in oil refineries.
Absolutely.
They're just burning off.
That's called a flare stack, and they have to burn
gas.
Off. They either have to use the gas or burn it off.
And you're saying that they could have just captured this gas that they're venting and burning and put them in, if they had the structure, just feed the combustion.
Exactly.
But they're not.
They're not. And there's one case I went to. I spent a day at a power plant just north of Baghdad called Quds. And this is a heartbreaking example because they have 8 turbines there. 4 of them are these extremely finicky. Among combustion turbines, there are ones that are even harder to run than others. And 4 of them are a type that's very difficult to run and almost impossible to run on anything but gas. And the heartbreaking part about Quds is that literally across the street, natural gas is coming up out of the ground and being burnt off. And I saw it as I approached, as I went into the Quds plant. And I pointed to the flare stack and asked an engineer, at this big orange flame I was seeing, I said, how much gas is that? What could you do if you were capturing that gas? It's literally just across the street. He said they could run 2 of their 8 turbines. There were 4 that they weren't running because they had improper fuel. 2 of those 4 that they weren't running, more than 60 megawatts of electricity, they could have been running off just that one flame I was seeing.
Just piping it across the street.
Piping it across the street.
Well, what's holding up from piping it? It seems very simple.
Well,
is simple in Iraq.
Yeah, well, there's actually nothing is simple in Iraq. This, in terms of like a developed country or a stabilized country, this would be simple, frankly. You'd have to capture the gas. You'd have to pressurize it. You'd have to build a very short pipeline just to get it across the street. You'd have to clean up the gas a little. You don't burn it just right as it, you know, you have to take the humidity out of it, I think. There's a few little things you have to do, but it's easy stuff. In fact, at different points, the Iraqis and American officials set aside the $30 to $50 million that they know it would cost to do this. And that money apparently just disappeared. It was part of a larger disbursement of money aimed at trying to solve this fuel problem, this lack of natural gas problem, that apparently went into the Ministry of Finance, and the trail just goes cold at that point.
How much money just disappears in Iraq? Do you get a sense
of
bumping into people all the time saying, well, the money disappeared someplace?
I was focusing on electricity.
Right.
So, as you know, there's the key oversight going on right now is in the office of Stuart Bowen. And he has made the charge that he believes as much as, I believe the latest figure is $8.8 billion, has just gone unaccounted for. And there is wide assumption that it was basically stolen or went into illegitimate uses. In my own travels, the engineers told me about $300 million that they traced into the Iraqi finance ministry that had been set aside for gas projects and that they were then unable to account for. Mm-hmm. That, and this was several engineers who told me this same story, who had been working on that project and had access up to the point where the money just vanishes.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in my introduction that there were hearings going on in Congress about the utilities in Iraq, and we're just talking about the electricity here today. You mentioned in your article an interesting thing about the power grid and the power that gets to Baghdad before the war and what gets there now and how that has changed and why.
Right. This is probably one of the biggest misconceptions that people have about power in Iraq. Before the first Gulf War, Iraq had somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 plus megawatts, 5,600, I think, is a figure I've seen of megawatts. That's before 1991. Before the second Gulf War, Iraq had something like 4,500 megawatts of power. Iraq has a population of about 25 million. This is not a lot of power for that number of people. So let's say even 5,000 megawatts, which is what Iraq had before the first war and what Iraq had as recently as October when I was over there. They had about 5,000 megawatts. What was going on then was in Saddam's day, Saddam decided that parts of Baghdad were going to get 20 to 24 hours of power a day. And they did. However, in order to do that, major portions of the rest of the country had to get 3 hours a day or 6 hours a day or 8 hours a day of power. The way Iraq is set up is there are large, or historically and traditionally, and even to this day, the way Iraq is set up electrically is that there were large numbers of oil-fired plants in the south, the predominantly Shiite south, and there were many hydroelectric plants in the north, which is partially Kurdish. And lots of their power was being funneled to Baghdad, so that Baghdad, there weren't that many plants around Baghdad, or not nearly enough. Baghdad is 40% of Iraq's electrical demand. So there weren't nearly enough plants around Baghdad. So under Saddam, that's the way it was. Now, with the Shiite south and the Kurdish north with much greater autonomy, they're getting much more of the power. I was told on pretty good authority while I was there that in October that parts of the Shiite south were getting 15 hours of power a day, as opposed to, say, six or so in Saddam's era.
So the fact that they are getting more power, you have to take into the account that it's robbing Peter to pay Paul's, right?
Right, exactly.
Baghdad's not getting the power now.
Right now, Iraq, the latest figures I saw is Iraq has about 3,900 megawatts. And pre-war, like I say, pre-second war, the most recent war was 4,500. Mm-hmm. And it goes up and down. Like I say, in October, there was about 5,100 megawatts. Mm-hmm. But there's a little less power. It fluctuates. But the situation in Baghdad is much worse than it was before the war. And I think that's what gives this impression that overall the electricity is far, far less than it was.
Talking with Glenn Zorpet, who is executive editor of the IEEE Spectrum magazine, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, author of a really informative and very almost discouraging article in the February issue of IEEE Spectrum about seeing, first you see how difficult it is for these engineers to just even get around with the protection they need.
Absolutely.
And the almost a Sisyphus-like effort to roll this up the hill.
Right. It is. It's extraordinary. I mean, a lot of people don't realize what it's like to work there or get anything done, let alone engineering. But I had the privilege of going out with some of these incredibly brave folks. If you're an engineer and you want to just do something routine, go out to a power plant or a telephone switching office, which is a thing an engineer has to do all the time of that sort, you can't just do it. You can't just get in your car and go. You have to schedule what's known as a PSD, a personal security detachment, and you got to do that 48 hours in advance. So you have to know that in 2 days I'm going to want to go to this plant, or if you find out you need to go, you have to go. You have to wait 2 days. A PSD shows up the morning that you're going to go. It's three what they call level six up armored SUVs. What that means is three SUVs with a whole ton of bulletproof stuff in the doors, bulletproof Lexan glass, the whole thing. And three of them show up with eight shooters, what they call shooters. These are mostly ex-special forces guys.
And private contract.
Private security guys, exactly. Right, right. Some of the Army guys out there refer to them as mercs, mercenaries, but they don't like to be called that. But they're private security contractors. Mm-hmm. They're paid more than, many of them are paid $1,100 or $1,200 a day, and it's all tax-free. But, and that sounds great, but if you knew how many of them were killed, it's in the hundreds, the number of these mostly young men who've been killed. Anyway, they show up. Eight of them, two in the front SUV, two in the middle SUV where you sit, two people with two other of the security guys in front, and then four in the rear car. And you travel to the site. And the way they do it is they've generally been trained. They all have different ways of doing it. I went with a firm called Aegis, which is a British-based firm. And they drive a very aggressive style. They're constantly looking for things, for danger signs, people on the roadside. And they also keep people from approaching your caravan there, your SUV. They will fire pin flares into the road. They'll wave orange flags. They'll fire shots in the air to get the attention of drivers who they feel are approaching or are too aggressive. And that sequence will escalate until they will actually shoot out the radiator of a car, which happened with a convoy just before mine, or they will put a bullet through the windshield. There are a lot of things they go through before they shoot to kill, but they will go to that if that's what it takes. So this is how you get to where you're going to work.
If you just want to read a meter at the place.
Exactly. If you just want to check a figure,
you
have a meeting with some plant technicians.
2 days in advance.
2 days in advance. You've got to wear body armor while you're in the armored car. And I get the impression that a lot of these engineers get used to it. I mean, amazingly. The first time I went out with them, I had a lot of butterflies. The second time I was a lot calmer. They don't talk about it. No one talks about being scared but I got to imagine that after a while it's.
Yeah, it becomes just another day in the office. Well, we're going to talk more with Glenn Zorpet, executive editor of the IEEE Spectrum magazine, author of Re-Engineering Iraq, February issue. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Take some of your phone calls. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Glenn Zorpet, executive editor of IEEE Spectrum magazine. His story about rebuilding Iraq's power grid is in the magazine's February issue. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You were telling us the day in the life of a contractor, and this is because the insurgency is still very strong.
No, it's huge, and they've really, really targeted the electrical work. It's not like they've left alone telecommunications, but it's nothing compared to electrical.
What kinds of targets are we talking?
The big things that they have made it almost impossible for the reconstructors to do anything in what is known as linear infrastructure, transmission lines or oil pipelines. In other words, things that are long. You can't secure something that's 200 miles long. Mm-hmm. So you can work on a power plant. You can do some of that, but even there, they can wreak havoc. But a big long type thing. Almost impossible now. They're doing almost none of that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your article that because electricity is so spotty, there is a black market in electrical generation.
Right, exactly. In Baghdad alone, it's estimated that there's something like 1,000 megawatts of connected diesel generation. And this is dirty. It's dangerous. Basically, somebody sets up a big old dirty diesel generator and runs wires, sometime like stereo speaker wire, from this generator to somebody's house. And if somebody else wants it, they run a different pair of wires to somebody else's house. And so when you go around Iraq these days, you see these hideous rat nest-like tangles of wire all over the place.
Well, did you come away thinking, you know, if they just would take steps A, B, C, D, this could be fixed?
Yeah, but you can't stop at D.
Well, give me an idea of what those steps might, what are the biggest problems and how would you... you solve them if you were one of those engineers, or you could make policy.
Yeah, there are big problems and little problems, and there are some that you could hope to start working on with the insurgency still as it is, and others you really kind of have to wait for the insurgency to wend its way. Certainly, the electrical rates being charged in Iraq are an enormous problem, maybe one of the biggest fundamental problems. Right now in Iraq, for residential users, they're paying 7/100ths of a cent per kilowatt hour. So what does that mean? Well, here in the United States, we're paying about 8 or 9 cents per
right.
kilowatt hour.
100 times the rate.
Oh, yeah. Tremendous.
Right.
But even if you look at the region, in Syria, they're paying close to 2 cents a kilowatt hour. In Jordan, they're paying 7 or 8 or so. So even by the standards of that area, 7/100ths of a cent per kilowatt hour is almost like giving it away, which they're also doing, by the way, because a lot of people don't have meters. A lot of people, 20% or so of officially generated electricity is stolen.
Right.
So there's no appreciable revenue coming into the Ministry of Electricity. And until you get appreciable revenue, I'm not sure that you can really make progress.
So he can't even buy the fuel he needs then, you mentioned
right.
in the article, to run his generators.
The way they're running it now is the electricity ministry is getting oil from the oil ministry directly. And some people told me that they're getting it for free. Others told me that's not true. They are paying, but they're paying a tiny fraction of what the world rates are for that oil. And therefore, what's happening is the electricity ministry is getting lousy oil, dirty oil, just stuff that other utilities wouldn't burn.
The dregs of the oil.
Right. And that's making the problem even worse.
Because they're then using these oil-powered generators, which are hard to take care of anyhow.
Well, they're trying to use this oil in combustion turbines, which
right.
is a dicey proposition to begin with, even if you've got good oil.
Right. And while we have the gas one sitting idle.
Precisely. Or they're trying to run diesel fuel in the gas ones, things like that.
So would that be number two on your list? Get these gas powered, natural gas powered?
There's a bunch of things.
So many things you can't rank them in
right.
order.
But certainly I would say that it's at some point you have to just throw up your hands with some of these gas-fired combustion turbines and say, we can't do this until we can get a supply of gas. I would say that they've got to build a couple of steam thermal type plants, the old dirty, big baseload steam thermal type generating plants. Mm-hmm. They refuse to do them. The bad news about them is that they take 3 years to build, which is why they refused to do them initially. They wanted electricity fast, and a combustion turbine is 18 months. Steam plant is 3 to 5 years.
A political decision, you think?
It was a political decision.
We need to get this thing moving
fast
and not seeing the unintended consequences of going
exactly.
that
direction. No one was thinking, well, what if we can't get gas?
Right.
Someone was thinking that. There was a woman named Robin McGuckin who was thinking that, and she started raising alarm bells, but as near as I can tell, Not enough people were listening to her.
She's still around?
No, she's a development official now in India or Sri Lanka, I heard.
Maybe that's why she's not around. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Todd in Ogden, Utah. Hi, Todd.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I think that it's a great opportunity that the Iraqi people have right now to secure their own destiny. And all of us here in America take for granted being able to turn on the light or listen to the radio. And I think your commentator's looking at the mark inside the box of building these large plants and having infrastructure and new grids built. When I think technology is partially going to be the solution here, that an independent source of electricity that's based at someone's home. And typically here in America, you have a lot of people that, you know, will opt to be off the grid. And I kind of would like to know his outlook on these new technologies, whether it be photovoltaic cells or solar energy or any other combination that you could use to not have to be based on a grid.
If you're going to start over, why centralize it again? Why not?
I think that there's a large opportunity in Iraq for decentralized generation. I don't see it being at people's homes because of the expense. Your caller mentioned photovoltaic cells, which are a wonderful technology, but they're expensive even in the developed world now. And with Iraq, you're looking at average family income these days of about $150 a month. There's almost no way you could put in photovoltaic cells in people's houses and expect that they could pay for it. However, the general idea of decentralized electricity is a great one for Iraq, as indicated by the fact that there's 1,000 megawatts of quasi-illegal diesel generation all over Baghdad now. I mean, in one of my opinions, we were talking about what's the way forward before. This may be a way forward. The electricity ministry may look at this and say, and co-opt it, if you will. Make it official, make it cleaner and safer. People are getting electrocuted, hooking up these stereo speaker wires to a diesel generator and trying to supply a small household. Make it legal, make it safe, clean it up, and you might have something that's a good contributor.
Did you visit any city that seemed to be working well, that was a model city that the others could emulate?
I spent part of a day and part of a morning and an afternoon in Sadr City, which is the big, giant kind of Shiite ghetto in northeast Baghdad. And I saw a lot that was pretty encouraging there. The reconstructors have spent more than $500 million there. It was a great place to do reconstruction. It was a place that Saddam didn't have much use for. There hadn't been a whole lot of development or attention to their infrastructure. So the coalition has been trying very hard there. And they came up with a program to upgrade and refurbish the distribution systems in these sectors. Sadr City has 83 sectors. Each about 16,000 people live. It's an amazing place, 20 square miles, 2.5 million people. And it's split up into these 83 sectors, each of which has a 10 or 20,000 people. And they went in and for $1.6 million, which isn't much in the context of reconstruction, they completely redid the electrical system, gave them a good, safe, solid electrical system, put in streetlights, cleared out this rat's nest of tangled wires and illegal generators. And it worked so well that they've now come up with a plan where they're going to be spending, where basically the U.S., under the, I believe it's DOD funding, is going to supply the $1.5 million, and the Ministry of Electricity is going to supply the labor to do this work. And they're going to go sector by sector all the way through Sadr City. That's just starting now. That's very exciting. I think that's going to work.
Could it be a model for other parts of the city or other parts of the country, or is there something special there that makes it work here?
There's one thing that is special, and the coalition is adopting this countrywide already, which is that they have the buy-in of the locals. Early on in reconstruction, reconstructors would often just show up and start working, and they would suffer casualties. So what's happening now is they're often going into neighborhoods or villages and saying, look, we want to do this. Will you support us? And there's an implicit understanding that what support means is keep the bad guys away. And that's also been a great success. They've been doing that more and more. For example, it's something they did for these Sadr City projects, and I think it's something that they could do elsewhere.
So do you think that getting the cooperation of the Iraqis is key to any of this stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Any of it, if we don't have their cooperation, if they don't want us there, if the insurgents don't want to help combat the insurgents, nothing is going to happen.
Right. Yeah. You just, without safety, you just can't really have meaningful work done on the scale that needs to be done to make a difference in reconstruction in any of these sectors, really.
Mm-hmm. Did you come back encouraged or discouraged from getting there, or just observing?
Well, I guess it was a mix of feelings, but I have to, I think that... I'll be honest. Some of the news was very discouraging. The number of problems. I knew that there were some problems before I went over there, but I had no idea that how many problems there were and the complexity. But on the other hand, I don't think these are utterly intractable. And there is some good news here. I mean, first of all, as we noticed, as we spoke about before, Iraq has roughly the amount of power it had before. The reason why there's a big problem, and there's all this anger is because the demand for electricity is hugely greater. And we have to ask, well, why is the demand hugely greater now than it was before? Well, because Iraqis are buying refrigerators and air conditioners, television sets. You see little satellite dishes, TV satellite dishes everywhere in Iraq now. So these people have TV. A lot of them have internet access now. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people have access to internet now who never had it. So certainly there's a silver lining here. The average Iraqi has although there's unquestionably, there's a lot of danger in the country now, they are able to have things that they didn't have before.
Mm-hmm. And they want more things.
And they want more things.
And they don't want to pay the price
right.
for electricity.
You know, it's funny because we mentioned these illegal diesel generators before. And in some cases, I was told by sources at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad that people are paying, in many cases, many times the amount of money for electricity from these illegal sources than they were being asked to pay from the official sources. But they're paying it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that tells you right there that there is an ability and even a willingness to pay for electricity.
Talking with Glenn Zorpet, executive editor of the IEEE Spectrum magazine on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. In your article, you were talking about there's some cases where if they agreed that they would allow a generator to be built here, they had to have a special switch in it that they could cut it off of somebody else's power
right.
supply.
Absolutely.
Is there that kind of turf battle going on?
It's amazing. There's utilities in developed countries generally have something called a SCADA system, which stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition, I believe. What it basically is if you need to control your big electrical grid, you don't have to get in your car and drive to a substation 20 miles away to throw a switch. You can sit at a central control place and throw these switches for your electrical grid. It's tough to run an electrical system without one. Iraq had one years ago. It was kind of knocked out of commission around the time of the first Gulf War. And there was an enormous loss of maintenance and a maintenance culture that occurred between the wars during the embargo years. Although you can't really blame it on the embargo was what I heard. Saddam just got other priorities. But the SCADA system basically vanished before the time of the second Gulf War. That's another thing I might mention is that the U.S. avoided targeting any of the electrical infrastructure in the second war. They did consciously target it during the first war. But in the second war, they did their best to not damage any electrical infrastructure at all. But the infrastructure did suffer enormous damage due to looting in the chaos
right.
that ensued after the war. So, okay, among the things that were lost for good in this looting or before it was Iraq's SCADA system, which was primitive in any case. Now, given the situation in Iraq with, you know, dangerous swaths of the country and so on, a SCADA system would be a good thing to have. And it's not only because of the danger, but also because we mentioned before a little bit how the way the situation in Iraq is now is that Baghdad is getting 3 hours of power, 5 hours, 6 hours, what have you, whereas down in Basra, there are a lot of people getting 15 hours of power a day. Well, the way this happens is what's known as a dispatch operator sitting in a substation is throwing switches to turn on what are called feeders. A feeder... You throw a switch on a feeder and hundreds of houses in this neighborhood light up.
Right.
You turn the switch the other way and they're dark and very upset. So what's happening in Iraq now is there are these distribution operators who are sitting in rooms like we're sitting in.
Right.
Throwing switches and making people very happy or very angry.
You could pay this guy off to throw you the switch versus the other guy.
Exactly. And that's what's happening. You have people bribing these guys, you have people threatening them, you have sheiks and others exerting their influence. Mm-hmm. What's supposed to be a fair situation where neighborhoods are getting their electricity, this neighborhood is getting as much as this neighborhood, but just different times of day,
right.
and so on, it's not happening. It's kind of a mess. So the beauty of a SCADA system is that you could take out these men
people,
who
right,
have these
right.
people who have to
yeah,
sit there and
right.
throw switches and be intimidated. And you could have a situation where there's a person who's heavily protected and guarded and who is controlling enormous amounts of the grid from one place.
Mm-hmm. But that means that you back to the original idea, without heavy protection, guarding, security, the system is going to remain extremely vulnerable. All the whole electrical grid.
Yeah.
Power distribution.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've run out of time, Glenn, but I want to thank you. This is a really interesting article, and I suggest if you really want to know about what's going on and helping to rebuild Iraq, you check out Glenn Zorpet's article in the IEEE Spectrum, the February edition, Reengineering Iraq. Thank you, Glenn.
My pleasure.
For joining us today. Glenn Zorpet, executive editor of the IEEE Spectrum magazine. Our program today was produced by Annette Heist, senior producer Karen Vergoth. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington and Charles Berquist in New York. Our interns are Flora Lichtman and Andrea Thompson. Barry Hardiman and Becky Vlamis worked the phones for us today. Thank you. If you'd like to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can leave us email or you can write us the classic mail way, Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. But if you surf over to our website, you can also get our podcasts there. So you can download this program or back editions of Science Friday and sign up to get it every week. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. The free teaching material that we make for teachers having trouble teaching science, need a little help? We're making free teaching material for you on our website. Just click on the Teachers button on the left. I'm Ira Flato in New York.